From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Michigan's Republican legislative leaders go to the White House to talk to President Trump about his desire to subvert the will of Michigan voters.
We're talking about 154,000 votes. But this is not going to change.
Also, the founders of Michigan's new black-owned brewery label talk about carving out their place on the craft beer scene and starting a business in a pandemic.
You know, I kind of got a little emotional, you know, just to see our beer coming through the can line because it's been a grind.
Plus, the soul power of Michael and Tanya Trotter, a married couple from Michigan who perform as the War in Treaty. They have a new album, Forged in the Fires of 2020.
I miss sharing art and creating love, and this year has taught us to never, ever take it for granted.
Those stories coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on the program, two guys from Grand Rapids and their dream of a new beer in 2020.
Starting a business is hard in great times, you know, and it gets even more difficult in, you know, times that aren't as good.
With a great deal of elbow grease, Black Calder, the new black-owned beer brand on the block, is taking pre-orders. We'll meet the founders. But first, this morning, Michigan Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey was seen in Detroit boarding a plane for Washington, D.C. He and House Speaker Lee Chatfield were invited to the White House to meet with President Trump. So why would a sitting president issue an invitation on less than one day's notice to two state legislative leaders? Trump has targeted Michigan in an attempt to subvert the vote and overturn election results. Results that handed the presidency to Democrat Joe Biden by a margin of more than 154,000 votes. Many of those involved are not talking about the meeting. Zach Gorchow is the executive editor and publisher of Gong War Michigan. Zach Gorchow, welcome back to Stateside.
Good to be here.
Do we know why the Republican leadership agreed to this meeting?
No, we don't. They have not said anything publicly about this. It's been kept very, very quiet. We just know lots of little pieces. We know that the president's team has been trying to overturn election results in multiple states, getting states, trying to convince states to not certify their tallies. And we know that there is an argument advocated by some people in the president's camp and some Republicans that perhaps there's a way for the legislature and legislatures in various states to try to subvert how electoral votes are usually awarded by states.
Yeah.
So we just have all these pieces and they're going to Washington.
Just to be clear, there is nothing in Michigan's constitution or in Michigan's precedent that would suggest that electors could be sort of randomly reassigned at this point, correct?
That's correct. Michigan law is very clear. The certified winner of the presidential election in Michigan, the person who gets the most votes, gets Michigan's electoral votes. A theory that's being advocated by some conservatives who point to the U.S. Constitution, which says that legislatures shall direct the manner in which electoral votes are awarded. Now, I think most attorneys will say that Michigan's legislature has directed the manner in which electoral votes are awarded by passing a law that the certified winner of the election gets the electoral votes. So I think I've seen this is described as a legally dubious theory. I think that's probably right on. Nonetheless, we're in strange times, and I'm not going to just dismiss strange possibilities from happening out of hand.
Senate Majority Leader Shirkey already several days ago slapped down the idea that Michigan's legislature would reject the will of the voters and try to hand electors to President Trump. We all know that sometimes there is wiggle room in what our elected officials say as conditions change. Do you think this could be one of those times?
I wouldn't dismiss anything right now. You know, if you had told me yesterday morning that President Trump was going to summon Speaker Chatfield and Senate Majority Leader Shirkey to the White House and that they would go, what's the line in Christmas Vacation? If I had woken up with my head sewn to the carpet, I wouldn't be more surprised than I am right now. That's pretty much how I felt. So yes, Senator Shirkey did tell Bridge Michigan, I think something like, quote, that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. He did say that. Those are just words. They don't bind him to anything.
Zach, what are some of the conversations happening right now in Lansing political circles about norm breaking and the challenges that we're seeing to our democracy?
I think it's just sort of a continual everyday sense of jaws hanging agape that this is where things are, that there are a number of Republicans who I would describe as Republicans who have been active in the party for a long time, who have said, you know, the president has every right to wait for the canvass to be complete, to even ask for a recount, press challenges in court, but that they've also said there needs to be a recognition as well that none of those challenges are going to result in reversing a 154,000 vote margin. They're just not. It's way, way too large for something like that to change. And that if it was couched in that respect, President Trump had simply said, we recognize we are behind. We are going to await the canvass. We intend to ask for a recount just to be sure. That would be one thing. But that's not what's happening. The president is, you know, saying that fraud decided the Michigan result. You have a number of Republicans out there saying things like this election was stolen, and there's simply no evidence of it. It just seems to be, you know, so then you have a number of other Republicans who will say, you know, are trying to say, boy, how do we get this resolved without, you know, damage being done to democracy? I mean, you've seen Congressman Mitchell, Republican from Lapeer County, saying things like this. But most elected Republicans are not saying very much. I don't think I'm wrong in saying that most people around Lansing are very, very concerned. It would be one thing if this was an election decided by 1,000 votes or less, then yes, this would be very much in doubt. I mean, we saw during the canvass, I think the vote changed by about Biden margin increased by about 7,000 or 8,000 votes. That's normal in a canvass. Hillary, you know, Trump's margin decreased by about 3,000 votes, I think, in 2016. Statewide votes see the canvass change things some. We're talking about 154,000 votes. It's just not going to change.
Let's talk about what's coming in the days to come. On Monday, the Board of State Canvassers is meeting. Their task is to certify Michigan's election results. And a lot of people have been wondering if this is going to be a replay of what happened with the Wayne County Board of Canvassers, at which there were Republicans who said they weren't going to certify the election and Democrats who said that they were. One of the Republican members of the State Board of Canvassers, Norm Schenkel, told the Washington Post he's strongly considering a vote not to certify election results on Monday. Have you thought this through, if the board deadlocks, what that does to the process?
Well, yes. So there's two Republicans and two Democrats on board. You have to have a majority to certify the vote, which means you have to have at least one person from each party voting yes. And if they were to deadlock 2-2, and refuse to certify, the first thing that will happen is the Biden campaign, presumably, among maybe others, will file for an immediate, what's called writ of mandamus in the Michigan Court of Appeals, ordering the Board of State Canvassers to certify the vote. We've seen the board deadlock many times on ballot proposal language, ballot proposal, certifying signatures for ballot proposals. But to my knowledge, the Board of State has never deadlocked on certifying an election. So I would expect that they would go to court quickly. We would have a fairly quick decision from the Court of Appeals, and then that would likely be appealed one way or the other to the Michigan Supreme Court, which then need to make a quick decision as well. You know, I'm not going to make any predictions about what the courts would do, other than, you know, we did see a pretty conservative panel of the Court of Appeals totally smacked down the Trump campaign's request that it stop the certification process in Wayne County, which, you know, I don't think bodes well for the Trump campaign. But again, I'm not going to try to crystal ball this.
Yeah. Well, at least it sounds like there's some procedure that we have seen before in Michigan, if things go that way.
Yeah, it definitely ends up in court, no question.
Zach, this is a year in which we've seen Michigan's legislative leadership take stands contrary to what our public health officials are saying. This is a year in which Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey was in the gallery talking to some people who included numbers who were arrested with the Wolverine Watchmen, talking to them about their concerns on a day when there were mass protests at the Capitol. Now we've got the two senior most elected Republicans in the state going to the White House at a time when the president appears clearly invested in overturning Michigan's election results. And you just mentioned that there just really hasn't been nobody's really talking right now about what's happening. What happened to moderate Republican thought in Michigan? Do you know if there are members of the caucus or otherwise who have concerns about what's going on here?
I just think that, you know, this is President Trump's Republican Party, that by and large, this is a, you know, a party now that is in lockstep with President Trump and President Trump's goals. And there's not a lot of daylight between your average elected Republican and the president. I mean, no, most of them aren't out there on Twitter blasting away on an hourly basis, no. But from an ideological standpoint, many of them agree with his philosophies and policies. You know, certainly the Republican Party has been on a trajectory that's being more and more, I don't even know what the term conservative is really means anymore. There's certainly a lot of conservatives out there who would say they don't recognize the Republican Party as a conservative party anymore. But, you know, it's been moving in a, you know, a rightward, more populist direction for many years. And, you know, that's where we're at now. And there, you know, the Democratic Party has moved left. You know, you don't see really any, there really aren't any conservative Democrats anymore. When I first started covering the legislature, there were a lot of conservative Democrats in the legislature. They're gone. Just like there were a lot of moderate Republicans in the legislature when I first started covering it, and they're gone too. I think it's just a product of the polarization of our politics nationally.
Zach Gorchow is executive editor and publisher of Gongwer, Michigan. Zach, thanks for helping us comb the spaghetti.
Thanks for having me.
Next up, Albion natives Michael and Tanya Trotter of The War and Treaty. They'll talk about their latest album, their marriage, and all the struggles of 2020.
Heartstown was written and composed during a moment where we were just straight up reflecting, self-reflecting on ourselves and on our relationship and on our world.
That's next. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Do you ever find yourself flipping through your music options, looking for that magic blend of songs that reflect the pain of 2020, but that also heal? We think we found your fix.
Can we be lovers now? Let go of the past that hunts us down. Can we finally be found in each other's arms above the ground? Can we forget the skin we're in?
Michael Trotter and Tanya Blunt Trotter are a married couple from Michigan who record and perform as The War and Treaty. Their latest record, Heartstown, doubles down on their ravishing duets and their broad musical taste. Some of the songs soar like Stax Records, others frisk and sway with the grace of Cole Porter. The Trotters are from Albion, but they're living in Nashville right now. That's where we found them this week. Michael, Tanya, welcome to Stateside. It's great to hear your voices.
So good to be here. Thank you.
You know, the record opens up with this song, which just taps an artery of romantic despair and channels it into this incredible soaring anthem.
For you to stay.
But I have to say, when I heard it, my first thought as a person who has been married a while, as you two are, I thought, this is a grown love song.
Oh, hell yeah.
So true.
Why doesn't anybody write about couples who were in their second or third decade together?
I don't know. I think, you know, like everything, everyone just wants something new all the time. And, you know, the beautiful thing about being in something for two and three decades or a decade itself is that you're always finding something new in that person, and that's what makes it so exciting.
Would you say that that is a thread that runs through the songs on this album, you know, just being in a certain place in life?
I would definitely say so. And Ty and I, we definitely try to write from an honest place. And, well, we don't try, we do. So Heartstown was written and composed during a moment where we were just straight up reflecting, self-reflecting on ourselves and on our relationship and on our world. And that's what you have.
Right. Could you remind us the story of how you two met?
Ah, yes. Let's go ahead and argue, Tanya. Are you ready? Because here comes the argument right about now.
Well, let me start my side, and then he's going to tell his side, and then there is the truth. But we met at a love festival in Maryland, Laurel, Maryland, to be exact, and Michael was performing. I saw him on that stage performing with a friend of his, and it was amazing, and I just had to know who he was. So I darted across the field. If anyone knows me, they know I like to wear heels. They weren't red that day, but I loved, you know, that music that he was performing. And I met him, and right away I purchased, I think he had like these bootleg CDs, and I purchased like six of them, and I was giving them to everybody in on the that I could on the field. And we exchanged numbers, and that was it. He came over to my house. He had never done any writing for anyone before. But I asked him if he could write for my brother and I, who would, at the time we were working on our duet project. And Michael came back maybe the next day, and this was 2 weeks after his meeting, and he had the entire album complete. And I was like, this is strange. And these weren't like, you know, fluffy songs. These were magical songs. And so as time went on, maybe another 2 weeks, my brother couldn't make rehearsal, and Michael started to add reference vocals to those songs. And a friend of ours heard us singing together. And that was it. That was the magic.
I don't know who needs to hear this, but if a woman will run in heels for you, you need to go for that and hold on to it. That's important.
Tell us how you lost my number now.
Nope, we can move on.
Oh, no, you did not.
All lies. All lies.
You mentioned, you know, you said that this entire record was written, you know, that the exterior of this would suggest a relationship that is solid if going through questions, but you said that there was definitely a reflective period that came with the writing of this. Could you say more about that?
Well, just again, we just really want to make sure that we are honest in our art form and making sure that we're telling the correct story, the story that we want to tell. And for me and Tanya, it was definitely a moment of just figuring out what we want to lead with. You know, do we want to go this way or do we want to go that way with it or whatever it was? And as we continue to try to process what we were going through as a couple living in this country, one of the things that we decided to do was just be completely honest with how we felt. And that's just, you know, what you have and what you're hearing is where the road to honesty has led us. And there's more. And I'm excited about the more part. But I'm also excited about that we got this out.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Tanya Blunt Trotter and her husband, Michael Trotter. Their band is The War and Treaty. So you're from Albion, but you guys are living in Nashville now. Can you fill us in on what this year has been like and just sort of what the immediate environment has had for you?
To some, it's been scary, but this year has been so eye-opening for us and so reflective, and we were able to find the gaps in how we see things. Because you're on the road a lot and you get burnt out and you get tired and you complain and you don't want to go home. I want to be in my own bed and I want to drive my own car and blase, blase. And failing to realize that this life you live is a privilege and it can be here today and gone the next. And I wish we were opening on the road. I wish we were doing headline shows on the road. I miss people. I miss watching them respond. And I miss responding to them and sharing art and creating love. And this year has taught us to never, ever take it for granted. Don't ever think that it will just always be this way and the trajectory is just up, 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 up. Because something can happen. Anything can happen to where we're all on the same playing field now. We're all sitting at home wondering what's going to happen next. And I feel that in the Trotter household and in Michael and Tanya's life, one of the things that we have bunkered down and done is just examine ourselves and really be grateful and thankful that we've been able to stay afloat.
I wanted to ask about one of the songs on the record called Five More Minutes.
Leaving so soon is like we just arrived. Did I play the right tune for your pleasure tonight? Stay with me, don't leave just yet.
Will you tell us the story that led to the writing of this?
Well, we were in Albion, Michigan, and for those that don't know about the Warren Treaty, we are a family that together we are thriving through the ups and downs of PTSD. Michael is a two-time Iraq War veteran, combat veteran, and we as a family have navigated the ups and downs of that.
Tasted the wine, smoked a little wisdom in the rain.
And this particular day, when we were in Albion, it wasn't a good day for him. And I kind of knew it. He'd been going in and out of just depression, you know, and I could see it heading towards a more severe path. And he had made up in his mind without me knowing, without him giving any clues or saying anything, that this day was the day that he was going to try to die by suicide. And I knew that. So I called his therapist and I talked, and she said, call the police department. And I did, the Albion Police Department. And while I was waiting for them to get there, I went to talk to Michael, and I, you know, got down in a posture right in his face and on my knees. And I asked him, I said, you know, I just need you to give me five more minutes. And then the police had arrived there, and they backed me with what I was asking him to do at that moment. And he had made up in his mind, Michael did at that moment, that he was going to not just give me five more minutes, but he was going to give himself five more minutes. And he did not go through with the act. So that is where that song derived from our experience and Michael's triumph through that moment.
I cannot believe that you two were able to turn such a truly hellish situation into such a hopeful and positive song. It's really beautiful.
Thank you. You know, it's interesting because, you know, the time that we're all going through right now, I think that in putting that song out without us even knowing that this time would come, that's kind of the way we live our life. You know, it's our daily, I would say, mantra. That's a famous word everybody's using now, is to keep hope alive. You know, that in every situation, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. And as long as you have someone kind of going through it with you and understanding and showing some empathy with you in that, then I think hope is always possible.
Michael, was there a conversation about what the treatment was going to be on that song?
No. We just went full speed ahead, and we wanted it to be happy. We wanted to reflect the aftermath and not the current situation.
Your voices are so beautiful and powerful together. I there's some couples, it's not quite the same as sibling harmony, but there's some couples who, when they sing together, it's just electrifying. Could you talk a little bit about your collaborative writing process?
I wish that it was a collaborative process, but, you know, I sent him a text message this morning because Michael is a genius. I mean, to be able to watch him work, sometimes I get stuck in the moment and I'm like, I guess I can add the word the to make, you know, it's so amazing because he hears everything at the same time. You know, he'll come to me with the song and he'll say, okay, here's the melody. Here's what the piano's going to do, the drums, the horns, the strings and organ. And then now that we have the studio in the house, he'll go and make a reference of it. And I'm like, okay, so there's really nothing for me to do. But we'll go through the song to make sure I understand the lyrics. If I want to change a lyric here or there to make it, you know, fit more or whatever, we'll compromise on that. But I mean, I've always said this, when you're in the presence of a teacher, your responsibility is to learn and to be a student in that. And there are just so many moments in the War and Treaty where I really am the student, regardless of the career I had before the War and Treaty. It's always a learning curve and it's always a challenge to hear these songs. So I would definitely give all the credit of the creative side of what we do to Michael and his 6-7 song a day process. He writes so many songs. It's just amazing to be a part of this journey with him.
Michael, is that really the volume you work on?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing. I mean, has it always come like that to you in such a flood?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I leave myself open to the voice of God, and God is always speaking, whether it's through nature, whether it's through the solar system, or whether it's through humanity and vegetation. He's always there, and I'm always listening. I'm ready.
Is there something about working at that pace that you think opens you up to hearing what you need to hear?
I realize that it's at that pace to others, and to me it feels like years.
Ah.
I'm so engulfed in the moment. Everything slows down. Time's suspended, and I'm with what is, what can be, and what will be of this material. That's where I'm at.
Mm. There is a song on the record called Beautiful that includes a cameo by, oh, by the way, one of the most famous men in music right now, Jason Isbell.
When I looked you in your face, from your eyes fell a tear.
What does Nashville offer you in terms of musical community and people who you can connect with and sometimes collaborate with?
It has, I would say, since we've been in the pandemic, we've done something that we have not done since we were on the road a lot. We're doing a lot of writing collaborations. We did one last week with Lucy Silva's, a couple of really well-known producers with our publishing company this week. And it's just been amazing, you know, to be able to experience and exchange energy with some of the most incredible artists and producers in this town. And to realize that even if we're unable to meet with them at their homes, we are able to Zoom and we are able to do FaceTime. So it's taught us that regardless of where we are, and we can be in Kansas City, this pandemic has opened the eyes of so many of us to realize that we can do this all day. Thank goodness for Zoom and FaceTime. You know, so we don't really necessarily have to be in Nashville, you know, to make that happen.
Right. You know, to that end, there's so many insanely talented musicians. Nashville's full of them, some of them session people who just never quite made it into the spotlight. How do you think you two were able to find your audience?
I think we're still finding them. Just being honest and true to who we are, people are starting to understand that this is it, you know, that this is real. And it's hard to make music today. Because so many people, they feel like they're looking for something new. And sometimes the answer is not in something new. Sometimes the answer is in what was. And just seeing a different interpretation. Not new, but different. So we're really, just really honing in on our people. And even our peers, like Punch Brothers, Chris Thiele and Aoife Donovan, and listening to like Sierra Hall or Sarah Jarosz or something like that. You know, it's just really just expanding yourself and realizing that it's an audience of one.
Mm.
And if you love music, then you'll love it all, you know?
Thank you two so very much. I mean, the record is just, it's medicine right now, and we appreciate your time in talking to us about it.
Thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
Jubilee, Jubilee.
Michael Trotter and Tanya Blunt Trotter are The War and Treaty. We sure are hopeful that they're in a place to tour safely at some point in 2021. Till then, their new album, Heartstown, is available online. Up next, the owners of the state's first fully Black-owned brewery talk about diversifying the craft beer scene and launching a business during a pandemic. Stay with us.
You're kind of singing, cutting through the noise. Jubilee, Jubilee.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. It's no secret that Michigan has an incredible wealth of craft beers and breweries. But while the microbrew industry is booming, it's obvious that it's lacking in diversity, from brewmasters to brewery owners. That is changing. We do know some part owners and brewers who are Black. But it struck us that the state's first fully Black-owned brewery is set to release its first beer next week. For now, Black Calder Brewing is contracting with a couple of other West Michigan breweries. But next year, they hope to have their own brick-and-mortar location to, as they put it, make dope beer for dope people. With us today are the co-founders, Jamal Ewing and Terry Rostick. Jamal, Terry, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, guys, can I just ask each of you, what beer was it that made you a craft brew nut? Terry, do you want to start?
Yeah, no, I can answer that easy. I've been drinking beer for a very long time. Dirty Bastard was one from Founders that really kind of turned me on to a lot of different craft beers. And, you know, at Brewery Vervant, they had like Wizard Burial Grounds. You know, I really found myself drawn to like some of these big, big beers that were bourbon aged because they're just so flavorful, right? You had the bourbon mm-hmm. notes, you had some chocolate notes in some of these things. So I'd have to say Dirty Bastard probably was my gateway. And of course, everybody tries Oberon. I don't think mm-hmm. you can count Corona as craft beer, but you know, I used to like those back in the day too.
We can talk about Corona. There's no shame here. How about you, Jamal?
I'd probably say Two Hearted. You know, I'm more of an IPA guy. So, like the, you know, the hazy craze that's going on right now too, so we definitely want to put some of those out, but I'm more of an IPA guy than a stout for sure.
Can you tell us about some of the places where you learned important things about brewing?
Yeah, I can answer that one. I learned a lot about brewing from, you know, my friends at Brevant, you know, Chris and Jason and Jacob, some of their head brewers and people there. You know, I would just hang around that place a lot and, you know, just soak up knowledge and do the beer tours. You know, I started reading books and bought some beer kits. You know, I have jokes sometimes. I tell people my passion for craft brewing started with Kool-Aid. You know, I used to be mixing up Kool-Aid in the kitchen and trying all these flavors, throwing fruits and things in them and just doing some crazy stuff until my dad shut that down. I think one day I wasted about a gallon of Kool-Aid. He was like, all right, you just make what it says on the package. But flavors, you know, is really just what's drawing me into craft beer and stuff like that. So
I'm a little bit newer, obviously, than Terry is. But, you know, in terms of homebrewing, you know, same thing. Started out with kits. And over the last year or so, I had a little bit of interaction with Eagle Monk in Lansing. I was able to brew with him a couple of times and get some pointers and tips. So that's been definitely a big help.
So here we are in 2020, and you guys are getting your venture off the ground. The first product off the line is Black IPA with a release date of, wait for it, Black Friday. Will you tell us about this beer?
Yeah, so Black Calder Black IPA, it's a 7% ABV Black IPA. We use Mosaic and Idaho 7 in a dry hop. So you'll get some chocolatey notes, a little bit of roast in there, and it'll finish off with some citrus. So a lot of the feedback that we've been getting so far has been great. You know, people are loving it, and we hope everybody loves it on Black Friday.
Why was this the beer that you wanted to launch with?
That's Jamal's baby. I'll just say that. It was one of the first ones that we brewed together, and Jamal loved it. And they're a tough beer to make. You know, black IPAs aren't very easy. You know, you can't really hide too much in there. And, you know, you also have a certain crowd, but, you know, Black Calder, Black IPA, Black Friday, you know, we had this great event that was going to be lined up. We called it the Blackish Friday, where we were going to have some beers on draft, have some Cajun food, and, you know, just have a really good time to have people come in and pick up merch. And then we had a shutdown that just happened because, of course, why not? It's 2020. So, you know, we've had to pivot. And so we're doing pre-sales today, actually at noon. Our pre-sales will be live, and then it'll be a pickup for Black Friday.
I've heard people say that if you can manage it, a recession, counterintuitive though it may seem, that a recession can be a fantastic time to start a business. I was just curious, what's your experience with that?
I say those people probably like pain. I mean, you know, starting a business is hard in great times, you know, and it gets even more difficult in, you know, times that aren't as good. But, you know, you do learn a lot about yourself. And, you know, this is where your character shines. You know, we had this plan of having our brick and mortar and, you know, having our own place to brew and, you know, just do some really cool things. And, you know, when 2020 hit, and it was like, okay, well, the restaurant industry became uncertain. And I don't think anybody's ever built a business plan that was, you know, designed with 50% occupancy or even less, or, you know, only outdoor seating. So, you know, we really had to pivot and adjust, and, you know, and I think that's like the true spirit of an entrepreneur is, you know, you just have to adjust. So, you know, contract brewing through Vervant has just been a great option for us. It's something we really never considered in the past, but just with the way 2020's gone and, you know, we've had all these great ideas and we wanted to get our beer out, we just didn't want to delay it anymore. So this just gives us a great interim as we, you know, we look forward to late 2021 getting our own building.
Yeah. It's never particularly easy for Black entrepreneurs to get small business loans. Was it difficult getting access to capital?
Well, Start Garden helped us a lot. You know, when we won the 100 ideas from Start Garden, that was great. You know, that gave us some free capital. Basically, you know, we won the $20,000 and, you know, that just helped us out with a lot because we've had some growing pains. And, you know, I don't think if we didn't have that money, I don't know if we'd even be here today.
Just for those who don't know, Start Garden is this business accelerator that helps businesses all over Western Michigan.
I mean, it really helped. I mean, we spend a lot of our own capital, you know, if it's 401ks. I mean, I've put a lot into getting this off the ground. So to have a beer today was, you know, I kind of got a little emotional, you know, just to see our beer coming through the can line because it's been a grind.
Yeah. What is the plan for this, for eventually getting a storefront of your own? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
So, you know, what we really want to do is we want to transform a neighborhood. You know, that's been very important to Jamal and I, is just being great community members. What you find in a lot of these breweries are, you know, when they're tucked in neighborhoods, it just brings the neighborhood to life, right? It's a walking place where people can gather and commune and, you know, have, you know, great beer and food. And that's the atmosphere that we want to create, you know, something where our kids, you know, I got two young kids, Jamal has two young kids. So, you know, we're not looking to make a bar, you know, we want to have just a brewery. You know, breweries are very different than bars. You know, 'cause they're family friendly. They're a craft, you know, they're a passion. Basically people who are in this industry are pouring their dreams in the glass for you to drink, you know, and I'm so excited for people to kind of drink our dream here in another week. I hope they like it because we do.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are Terry Rostick and Jamal Ewing. They're the co-founders of a brand new brewery in Grand Rapids. It's called Black Calder. What kind of, have you been eyeballing any specific neighborhoods in the area?
You know, in the very beginning, we really wanted to stay in the 49507 area. You know, it was a predominantly, you know, Black neighborhood that needed some investment. You know, there's no secret that there's been a lot of investment in Grand Rapids, but, you know, it hasn't normally been in the Black neighborhoods. And we thought this would be a great opportunity. But, you know, Jamal and I have just really been open up to a lot of different options. You know, at this point, we're taking our time and really just picking the right location that's going to not only transform a neighborhood, hopefully, but just give us the best opportunity to, you know, get our craft out to the most folks.
Yeah. Jamal, you had a really interesting quote in the press release that talked about why you two had wanted to take this on. And you mentioned that there were definitely beers that you were into and companies that you guys were kind of friends with, but that you didn't see your culture reflected in the brands that are out there. And it's kind of interesting because beer is a medium. It certainly reflects what people want to drink, but there are 1,000 forms that expression can take in a business, from the art that you use on your labels to the branding, the places and people that you market to. Terry, what are some things that you guys have talked about that, you know, things that you want to do or ways that this brand is going to look and feel different to folks?
Yeah, so, you know, we're definitely going to bring in, you know, some of that hip hop culture that we both grew up in and were immersed in. You know, you don't see that in a lot of craft breweries around here. You know, even our first art label for our can release, you know, is an iconic, you know, kind of fan art of an iconic vibe photo that had like Tupac and Dre and Snoop and Suge Knight when they're in their prime. You know, we plan on kind of bringing just that edginess and some of that hip hop culture that we grew up in. But we're also, you know, outside of hip hop culture, you know, Jamal and I were raised in very strong Black family households. And so, you know, we want to also highlight some of the other things outside of hip hop that makes the African-American community special. So, you know, we talked about, you know, making some beers that have coffees from Ethiopia and Africa. And, you know, and Jamal did a lot of studying and, you know, he can tell you about Egyptian brewing and all of that cool stuff. So, you know, we really want to bring a lot of culture and art and, you know, hip hop and just all the things that, you know, that makes our culture special, that everybody likes and shares. And, you know, sometimes folks still, but, you know, we're sharing it.
Oh my gosh, that's true. Egypt is the birthplace of beer.
Yeah. So like Terry mentioned, that's one of the things that I, you know, kind of learned along this journey is, you know, the origin of beer came from Egypt. You know, the Mesopotamians actually made, I guess, the first alcoholic substance, but it was more like oatmeal. You know, it wasn't an actual liquid that we drink today, but the Egyptians kind of got that recipe and modified it a little bit and made it into, you know, more of a liquid beverage that we drink today. So our logo is actually based off of a South African beer goddess, Mbaba Mwamawarse. And she was the Zulu goddess for beer.
You guys, I'm still stuck on alcoholic oatmeal.
Kind of kill two birds with one stone, right? You get full and you get a little imbibe.
Seriously, though, this has been a year in which Grand Rapids Black community has found some new gears. I think some people, but not everybody, were surprised to see the presence that came out for the Black Lives Matter marches. There's been some real solidarity and mutual aid among Black-owned businesses out of necessity. And not to mention, I think people might be aware, although this is going back maybe a little more than a year, there was a conversation that went on at Founders Brewery because of one of their Black employees who was really not comfortable with the culture of the place. I just wondered what you've observed about the community maybe coming into its own in a little different way in 2020. I don't want to understate what a difficult year this has been for everybody, but what's your experience of where people's heads are and where they're putting their energy right now?
I think it's been an eye-opening experience for some who just never realized maybe some of the struggles that people go through that don't look like them, you know, and that's from every side, you know, and that's kind of colorblind, you know, and as you think about, you know, the craft brew industry, you know, I have friends at Founders, you know, I know the owner of Founders, you know, I know some people there, I know a lot of people there, everybody that I've met and all the people in all of these breweries, you know, from City Built to Vervant to, you know, Speciation, I mean, everywhere. I just think there's just an awareness and an acceptance and just like people know there needs to be inclusion and it's just not going to happen naturally. It has to be intentional. Because if you don't intentionally try to include, you're going to inattentionally exclude folks. And so, you know, the craft brew industry is really paying attention to that.
Were there any people of color who you were able to talk with, or just even who sort of helped you see yourself and what you wanted to do and what might be possible when you were learning?
Yeah, so one of the big things for me was going to the Fresh Fest in 2018, the first Black Beer Fest over in Pittsburgh. And we met a lot of Black brewers there, you know, just to be able to see, you know, a lot of Black people just enjoying beer and brewing beer, something I hadn't seen before.
Yeah, and we get dubbed as, you know, the first fully Black-owned brewery, but, you know, Black people have had a lot of contributions to the craft beer industry before us, you know, and we obviously want to pay homage right. to that. You know, there's been tons of Black people who have been brewers that have, you know, worked in these pubs who have, you know, I wouldn't say integrated, but, you know, they were holding it down way before we ever knew what craft beer was. So, you know, to me, this is shared by everybody. You know, we like to pay homage to the folks who came before us and they're currently doing it and doing it at a high level. So,
I mean, it's hard to set goals at a time like 2020, where there's so much uncertainty, as you alluded to, and there's not a lot that we can say for sure about what kind of products people want or whether they're going to be able to have, you know, brand experiences the same way that they have in the past. What's important to you? What are your goalposts as you get into next year?
I can tell you what my goal is at 12 o'clock is to try to sell out of 80 cases of beer. That's my first goal. But, you know, our goal is just to, you know, to get open, you know, get a brick and mortar, you know, keep everybody safe. You know, safety is important, and, you know, hopefully vaccines come about and we can gather like we're used to, you know. But, you know, our goal is just to stay constant, work on partnerships, continue pushing the envelope and just bringing our flair to the industry.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's really just about the beer. I mean, diversity and inclusion is a part of it, obviously. It's something we want to see more in the Michigan craft industry, but and in the industry as a whole. But at the end of the day, you know, we got to make a great product that people love, and hopefully we can keep doing that.
Guys, one last question. I'm a Belgian girl in an IPA world. No disrespect to Ninkasi or anybody, but tell me about some of the other beers that you want to make down the road. What do you got for me?
So, yeah, we're definitely going to make some sour beers. We've played around with some of those before. We were going to do a collaboration here, which we'll probably still do eventually. But we were going to do this kiwi vanilla sour. I'm into the huge stouts. You know, that's what got me into the game is, like, you know, big, darker, heavier beers that really just kind of made me like, yo, I love craft beer. So I have a big Russian Imperial stout that I want to make. You know, we got another beer in the tank right now, which is just a regular stout, but I call it the bougie s'more stout. It's going to have, yeah, very bougie, right? It reminds me of my little sister, but, you know, and all these craft beers, you know, they all have stories, right? But, you know, it's when we were sitting outside and having a fire around the house, we were making s'mores and, you know, marshmallow, graham cracker. And then all of a sudden this dark chocolate Reese came out of somewhere. So that's what this beer is. It's like dark chocolate, peanut butter, marshmallow and a graham cracker. So I call it the bougie s'more because it was just so kind of like extra and over the top. So, you know, we got some cool things we want to do and get into ciders. We've also talked about possibly distilling in the future as we, you know, we label down our beers, you know, lagers, IPAs. Now that I know we have a Belgian beer fan, maybe we'll explore some of those.
Well, I don't presume to disrupt the creative process in any way. Everything you just mentioned sounds like something I would want to drink. Guys, congratulations and good luck for your first year of sales.
Thank you. Cheers.
Terry Rostick and Jamal Ewing are the co-founders of Black Calder. And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We're wishing you a nice, quiet weekend. We'll catch you next week.